Session number 11944.
Judge Gunand, Reel 6.
Well, I think we had a healthy respect for them.
For the Germans?
For the Germans. We did not like the Italians.
Why
was
that?
We always regard them as dirty fighters. There was a story, whether it's true or not, that somewhere down near Syracuse, one of the RAPs was attacked by Italians, and the wounded were killed. I think it was down in Syracuse or Port Augusta. That was one of the fables about them. And you always felt the Italians would were sly and would shoot you in the back, or would surrender and then somebody would shoot you, that sort of thing, trap you. A very cunning, underhand. We didn't like them. We didn't think they were terribly good soldiers. And of course that was from desert days. And I don't think the Italians in Sicily were any good soldiers. The Germans, on the other hand, were of course the people we came across, the Hermann Göring people. So they were all good soldiers and we respected them. I don't think we hated them in that sense. Don't think there was any sign of that. And that probably comes through, of course, from the fact we were all singing Lily Marlene, the Africa Cause song. We picked that up, and we were all friendly with the 90th Light and the 14th Panzer Grenadiers. We knew the people on the other side, and they knew us, and we felt in some way there was a sort of rapport. And this developed over the war years, and certainly in the desert, but it went on until the time of Rommel's death, when Montgomery sent an order round, which we all received, that was in writing, telling us that General Rommel, Field Marshal Rommel, whatever he was then, was not a British national hero and a decent chap. He was, in fact, a very dangerous enemy general, and this feeling of sadness must stop. I didn't message to that effect, but I think that went all the way through with the ex-Africa Corps people. I don't think there's any more that I think of about them.
Did you capture any of them during the time in Sicily?
Oh, we must have done, but I don't remember. I don't remember seeing many of them captured. I mean, they were either they were away before we reached them, going up the coast road, or they were dead, and it was simple as that. I don't remember capturing any.
And what about Italians? Did you capture many of them?
Well, the captain, the German, the gunner
captain. Captain.
Yes, and but I don't remember any of the others. But I'm sure we must have done. I have vague memories of groups of them sitting around, but nothing remarkable. It wasn't like the desert when they came in streams, I gather. I did see something.
Do you remember ever running up against Italian troops while you were out on a patrol?
No. No.
Were you exclusively in the Hermann Göring divisional area then?
On the East Coast. Yeah, there was just. Oh yes, there was one thing. You asked me what we were doing, what we did to amuse ourselves. Johnny Weekly, my company commander and myself, went off with a group of men back to Primosoli Bridge, and we erected a memorial to the brigade dead. It consists of a cairn made out of demolished pillboxes, German pillboxes, and into which was set a large marble plaque naming the regiments and explaining what it was for. I was interested to learn within the last 6 weeks that one of my former comrades in the 8th Battalion, Lieutenant Pridham, has been back to Primosoli Bridge and have a look. He was wounded there, and he found that the bridge itself had gone, had been replaced by a more modern structure. The road had been straightened. The memorial that Johnny Wheatley and I built has gone, but it's been replaced by a more substantial edifice into which the original marble plaque has now been set. So the record for the brigade is still there, which is rather nice. In that sense, the Italians have been very good.
When you got back to England, having been out of the country for some time...
Yeah, I should have said... Sorry, may I just go back again? One of the tragedies of the Sicilian landing, of which you've no doubt heard, was the fact that my old regiment, my old battalion, the 1st Battalion, the Border Regiment, were all dropped in the sea 5 miles out, and they were all drowned. So Jalland, quietly, by joining the Durham Light Infantry, had avoided being captured at Kos-Olyros or drowned off Sicily, so I was very lucky. That was only a few weeks. Anyway, sorry. You said when we got back.
I was going to ask you what impression England made on you when you came back to it, whether it had changed in any way while you'd been away.
No, don't think so. Very kind to us in Haverhill, very generous, hospitable, with their limited means, with rationing and everything. No real change.
You said you were preparing for the next big event, the invasion.
Mm.
And that Montgomery had been booed in Sicily when he mentioned that he would send for the 50th Division when he wanted something difficult done. Did that mood of that feeling that they'd done enough persist?
Oh, no. No, once we got back, that was fine. They'd been back to UK, because some of these men had been out there for years. But once they'd had a break in England, they were quite happy. They weren't to know, though, there was nothing mutinous about it. They were all ready to go.
So it wasn't a question of being war-weary, it was a case of being homesick.
No, yes, I think that's right. And, of course, there was a great advantage that not only did 50 Div come, but the 51st Div and 7th Armoured. So, in other words, we felt that we'd all come home together to do a good job. And I think we were quite proud to have been picked. I'm just checking as I speak to see if there's if there was anything in. Yes, I don't think I've missed anything. Sorry.
So, what form did the training take then?
Oh, it was field work and patrolling and night work and route marches at this stage, Haverhill.
These are all basic infantry skills, aren't they?
Oh, yes.
So it's effectively refresher or remedial training.
Well, not. It's not, because, you see, once we're brought back, we got a lot of reinforcement. So we're made up to strength again for the invasion. I think we're 1,000 strong when the invasion came. We had been made up, and a lot of the people were new, and, of course, there was a lot of the cleaning up to do and getting re-kitted, and George Stray, the quartermaster, had a tremendous job getting everybody up to strength with everything. And it was, in fact, very hard work again. We worked very hard during that period. Later on, of course, we left Haverhill and went to Southwold on the coast, again just for a short time, and that was where we used the Thetford battle training area. We were mixed up with the tanks. We did our tank cooperation there. We did combined tank and infantry exercises. We did a lot of firing up in Thetford.
Live firing.
Oh,
so
yeah.
It was a sort of live firing battle range.
Yes, and of course, Southwell was on the coast, and as you know, it had been evacuated of all unnecessary civilians. So there was nobody about there, just the odd person in the town, but most people had gone, though that we had the place to ourselves. You couldn't have a dance in Southwell because there were no girls.
This training you did with tanks, was it the first time you'd actually done any training on infantry armour corporation?
Yes, I think so.
How long did it take for you to get the knack of cooperating with the armour?
Well, I don't think it took any time at all, because I think the tanks seemed to have two roles. They seem to have their old cavalry role where they did tank charges and attacks of that kind. And they had a second role, which was infantry support, where they were really a sort of mobile pillbox and firepower. And they tended then to do as we told them on those occasions. One of the things I found in practice was that once men had been involved in an attack with tanks, it was extremely difficult to get them to move again without tanks in an attack. They wanted the tanks there, they wanted the big gun and the Browning machine guns. And also, of course, they wanted to be able to hide behind them, which was very useful. But there's tremendous cooperation between the armour and the infantry. And I think they had Churchill tanks at that stage. I think they had for the infantry tank. And I remember they had a telephone at the back. We were able to open the little box, telephone box thing, and telephone the tank commander, which is very useful.
Do you remember which regiment you trained with when you were in Thetford? Who the tanks were?
13th, 18th Hussars, were they? 17th, 21st Lancers. Cherry picker people, were they the 11th?
Royal Hussars.
Royal Hussars. I think those were the... I think that was the...
They were three regular regiments, weren't they?
Don't know.
Those three were regular cavalry.
Yes, I wouldn't know. I wouldn't know. They were very good. We got on terribly well with them. And all the way through, we always got over with the armour. We were very sorry for them with the 88s. Because they hadn't, we had a chance, they hadn't. Those centre tank guns. But and we had later on, in Normandy, we had occasions when the tank commanders had escaped from burning tanks and things, and in due course they came and kind of joined up with our infantry.
Did you do any combined arms work with artillery supporting you at Thetford?
No, I don't think so. I don't think I ever did it. Don't remember it ever. With a creeping barrage sort of thing. No, I don't remember it at all. May have done.
What about the Air Force? Did they put in an appearance
no.
at all?
Not then. They did in Normandy, my goodness, but not then.
But you didn't have any prior training with
no.
them?
No. And we were doing that training. This time, going back to East Anglia, it wasn't a case of coastal defence. We were doing this training. And subsequently, of course, nearer the time, we were moved down to Romsey, just outside Lord Mountbatten's Broadlands. And that was when it was the final bits and pieces were put together. I remember we collected our airborne bicycles at Southwold, and I was duty officer that night. And I got the message from Brigade to say we were to collect our airborne bicycles the next day. And I remember not accepting what my informant told me. I was quite sure he was having me on. But there was somebody in the mess ringing me up to say airborne bicycles. We've never heard of airborne bicycles then. And it was the same time that I, again, was on duty, I suppose, duty officer, where I found out that great consternation had been caused because George Stray, the quartermaster, had indented for 1,000 50-div signs, TT signs. 1,000, which is a reason for uniform quartermaster. And this had been misinterpreted en route. The result was the ordnance had received a request from us for immediate delivery of no fewer than 1,000 TT mines. And that really set them back. They started and they couldn't do it in the time and all the rest of it. And I had this silly conversation. I didn't know what they were talking about anyway. It wasn't my job. But I don't know, had you come across TT mines at all? TT mines were a very good device. They consist of a trough made of light metal, tin, that sort of thing. And they were filled with four Hawkins grenades, all wired up together with detonators and so on. And so you had a mine with four charges in it, four Hawkins grenades, measuring about 4 feet, four and a half feet long, which you could put on the roof of a truck or carry it around easily, or infantry could carry it. And it was possible, of course, to put that down on the road.
Close the road off.
Close the road immediately on any tank. So from that point of view, they were very useful, very good, those TT mines were like this. Weren't too keen on Hawkins mines on their own, Hawkins grenades. We never went in for necklaces, as far as I remember, but TT mines were good. That was Southwold. We were subjected there to air raids, of course. The Germans used to come in, ordinary irritation raids, bombing the town. One plane would fly in and drop a bomb or two and then disappear again. It was nothing.
It was
nothing
just harassing raids.
Harassing raids. All along the south, even the East Anglian coast. But it was also at that time that we hadn't, of course, been told anything about where we were going at this stage, and we've got no real idea. We knew we were going in the following spring sometime or summer. But apart from that, being reinforced and brought up to date, it really was, and the tank training and so on, it really was a quietish period with a feeling of anticipation, of course, behind it.
These new replacements, were they new recruits mostly?
Yes. Yes, we had a good dollop of those there. Subsequently, of course, in Normandy, we started getting reinforcements from divisions that broke up and units that broke up. We got those too.
When they arrived at the battalion, did they already have some good basic training?
Oh, yes, I think so. Of course, one of the difficulties with the light infantry is that, as far as maybe the ordinary soldier, is that light infantry drill is entirely different. So when you first join, the major mountain in your life is learning this wretched drill. Everything else seems to be the same. But a lot of people never got used to trailing their rifles instead of shouldering them. And but still I got used to it in due course, and I think most of them did.
And did they get absorbed very quickly into the...
Yes, the Durham's followed the usual system of putting one or two to a section. They didn't have a new platoon or anything like that. And then they were split up and moved around, but kept a preponderance of experienced soldiers. I was very annoyed just before the invasion. I'd been with my 13 platoon through Sicily and so on, all the training we'd done there. And 3 days before the invasion, they took me off out of B Company, which was then commanded by Ian English, I think. And they took me out of that one and put me with D Company. I think that was the right way around. It may have been the other way around, but I was very annoyed. They took all the men off me. They took me away. They gave me a new lot who didn't know me. And the reason they did it was that the commanding officer said that Major Clapton needed some experienced officers in his company. And I resented that at the time. I was very cross that I'd been treated that way just before the invasion, being given a whole lot of chaps I didn't know, the company I didn't know.
But how long did it take you to get to know them?
Well, fairly quickly. You learn fairly quickly. But I didn't like Tommy Clapton, the major, regular major. And he was killed very shortly. He was killed at Saint-Pierre. But he was the kind of man who, perhaps incorrectly, I always thought preferred to lead from the back. And I had that impression. In case anything serious happened at company headquarters and that the matter became disorganised, so he kept a little back and let somebody else go on.
Was he frightened of losing control?
Or being hurt? Yes, I think so.
Because that seems to have been the besetting difficulty of the First World War, that all the communication was by telephone, and commanders tended to be desperately anxious to keep in touch with the higher level of command, and they could only do that by being where the telephone was,
yeah.
And that was in the command post, not forward. And that they were frightened of losing control and coordination.
Oh, well, I don't think there's anything like that about it. I won't say exactly what I'm thinking, but...
I think you've made it fairly clear.
I think so. And he wasn't similar in his approach to the Brigadier in the Red Hat. And he wasn't the only one. Anyway, that was... I jumped a little, I think.
You mentioned doing this training in cooperation with ARMA and so on, and training to get the new recruits properly sorted out and integrated. What about specialist amphibious training?
Well, that tended to come later. We had two big schemes. Exercises, I think they're called. Exercise Smash 1 and Exercise Smash 2. Exercise Smash 1 was a landing on Hailing Island, an amphibious landing on Hailing Island. Exercise Smash 2 was an amphibious landing, I think it was Studland Bay, somewhere in South Devon down there, where we had the whole works. We went on the LCIs. And we did the actual landing. We paddled ashore and marched inland and so on. That was first class. But that was, I think, later. I think we'd moved down to Southampton area before we actually did those exercises.
The battalion had actually landed on the beaches in Sicily, hadn't it?
Oh, yes.
So they'd already done...
Yes, but Smash 1 and Smash 2 were jolly good exercises. Mm. And there was another one too, which we had, which was Neptune. We had a very big scheme called Neptune. I forget where that was now, but I know it was a very extensive one. Montgomery was there and in great form. That was very exciting and useful.
What sort of level were the SMASH exercises? Were they brigade level? Or?
Yes. Big things, and with the American Navy, and we were introduced at that. We weren't to know it, but we were in fact introduced to the ships who were actually taking it.
What do you think of the American Navy?
Oh, marvellous, absolutely first class. And they were so as I could see, they were very cool, calm, and collected. They knew exactly what they're doing. They're very efficient, and we got used to the cry over the lout, Hailer, Tannoy, now hear this. It came across. We thought they were absolutely marvellous. And I was, you know, they were nice people, all of them, the men, and very brave, because their boats were really very flimsy. And,
excuse me. Do you remember doing any amphibious training at all in Scotland at Inverurie?
No.
So you weren't sent up there to do the basics?
No. And, I do remember, again, a thing which people seem to have forgotten. We were, during that period, issued with escaping equipment. And this took various forms. Pair of fly buttons, which could be turned into a compass. A file for cutting through handcuffs, which we used to nail into the heel of our boots, so we could do that. There was a... Later on, we didn't get that to the beginning. Oh, yes. Yes, we did get it at the beginning. And that was a silk map of Europe, Western Europe, which we sewed into the hems of our battle dress. It was very, very fine. You put it around...
Rolled up.
Rolled up and sewn in. So that if we did escape equipment. So if we did escape, we could have got a rough idea of where it was without giving us. I mean, it was the whole of France, and so it was very useful. But again, people seem to have forgotten that sort of thing went on. They were very thorough. I was given a very interesting job at one stage, and again, this is going on later to Southampton days, and that was the we'd been introduced to these flails and crabs and various other funny equipment that the Royal Engineers had for cutting wire and blowing up mines and so on, heavy armoured stuff. And of course they were to do the initial assault to clear the beaches for us. And they had these, a lot of these. And this had to be kept from the enemy, that we had these devices. And I was given the job of going out for some nights onto the headlands on the south coast with four or five people with radio sets. And we were supposed to be a battalion radio network. And we all had our Sunray and Acorn and all the rest of it. And the idea was that we were to be pretend that we were carrying out an exercise, a practice, on the beach, and that we were to get into difficulties with the wire and the mines and the element C. And we used to have this, please send more wire cutters, you know, the men are in the wire, they can't get through the wire, we need more Bangalore torpedoes to deal with the wire. And we did this for about a week, purely to give the wrong impression, because of course we weren't going to get it tied up with the wire, never did. But it was a little sideline to the main operation.
This would all have been part of Operation Fortitude, wouldn't it? That was the deception plan.
I don't know about that. I never knew it as that.
Mislead the Germans about where we were going to land and how it was going to be done, and generally pull the wool over their eyes about intentions.
Well, I didn't know it was Operation Fortune. And it was merely Jalan sitting up on the cliffs amusing himself.
You mentioned all these things, the wire, the element C and so on. Did you actually have replica obstacles to practice on?
No,
I
don't
think. Training for
assault? Well, only the normal stuff we'd had through the all the time in the army, where you used to have a wire fence and you'd throw a Bangalore torpedo across it, or somebody would lie down on it and everybody would run across his back. That sort of training, we'd had that all the time. We had that at Sandhurst, getting through wire and wire cutters and so on. Just as at Sandhurst, I remember now you mention it, I'd learnt to use boats, river crossings with boats, folding boats. So that was, again, back at Sandhurst days. And Bangalore torpedoes, certainly with the dear Mr. Knight who was killed. He taught us to use Bangalore torpedoes, and they were very good. But it was all building up, really, for Overlord. And we eventually moved down to, say, Romsey, and in Nightingale Wood, where I shared a tent with Ian English again, which was rather nice. But of course it was during that period that I switched to Tommy Clapton. In due course we were all wired in behind high fences, and nobody was allowed out, and so on. We had briefings where we were told more or less what was to happen, but my junior ranks, lieutenants and captains and so on, weren't told where we were going even then. And I don't think I found out where we were going until I was actually on the boat. They were very secretive about it, and they developed an attitude which I wasn't at all sure was a good one. They may have been very careful, particularly for the danger of people being taken prisoner, for example. But I always felt that, as far as Normandy was concerned, there was a lack of communication, and it was, as far as the lower orders were concerned, the communication was very bad.
Now, that ran contrary to Montgomery's established policy in the 8th Army, didn't it?
Oh, yes.
Because he was keen on putting people in the picture.
Oh, yes, but this was... Overlord was mean we weren't told, we didn't know where we were going. As I say, there are limits to which you can go with this, and I think they've got to be secure and so on, but I think it went on too long, particularly on the other side. And I went on, as I was mentioning last night, with Ian English and Johnny Laybourne, they were saying, we did go down this way, didn't we? And Tony Pridham and I were saying, well, I don't know. I didn't know what was happening. And that was there's an awful lot of that in Normandy, I'm afraid. It was a jolly good campaign. Not belittling it at all, but I think we could have been told more. And that was the fault of the company commanders, of course.
Did you get any intelligence, though, about the geographical characteristics of your landing area?
We had photographs of the beach taken at sea level by reconnaissance planes. We had aerial photographs of the area. We had maps.
Presumably with the names blocked out substituted.
Yeah. So in other words, we didn't know where we were going. And we just kind of had an idea. And we didn't get our maps to use, actually, until I think we were on the boat. We never had a chance to get down to them and say, you're going down here, or we'll go round there, or this is Bayeux. Nothing like that at all. And I think, in fact, we moved initially. I think we were moved soon.